Miguel Gavilan Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Very special day we have today, where we're going to spend the entire hour with our good brother and friend and producer and radio visionary, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Listen to this. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today we present to you a very special program. We will feature an interview with our own Miguel Gavilan Molina, who has been a longtime radio activist, worked in the fields as a farm worker, worked with Cesar Chavez, has been doing radio, alternative radio, was a student activist and helped set up the first bilingual radio station in this country, and has been working here at Pacifica Radio KPFA on La Onda Bajita for decades, and on Flashpoints for the last 8 or 10 years. And well, Miguel, it's good to have you with us. And I've been wanting to sit down with you, particularly in the context of what's been going on up north, your community, with the killing of Andy Lopez. I know this brings back a lot for you. And I thought this would be a good time to talk a little bit about your own background. And then later on in this interview, we're going to talk about what you're doing now and why this killing of this young man is so important to you. But it is good to have you as our special guest on Flashpoints. And let me begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about where you grew up, how you grew up. I know that you worked in the fields as a farm worker.
Well, Dennis, I was literally born on the border of Arizona and Mexico. On this side of the border, the town is called Douglas. It's an old gold mining town. Right across the border, it's called Agua Prieta, which means black waters, dark waters. And I came into the States right before I was school age. My mother couldn't raise me. It was in the 50s, and she was a house maid and nanny for a rich family in the town of Healdsburg in Northern California. And not married, there's no way on earth in those times, you know, she could have me. So she had me on her way to visit my aunt who lives in the state of Sonora. And after I was born, literally a couple of days later, she was on the bus heading south of the border into Sonora and its capital, Hermosillo. And outside of Hermosillo, a few hours south of it, is a little town, a little village called Matape. And I was raised between Matape and Hermosillo till I was school-aged. At that point, my mother went to Mexico and brought me back for me to begin school. I got here, and I don't know, it was probably 1958, 1959, and before I started first grade, that spring summer, there was a sweep of the town Healdsburg by INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Immigration Service, and part of a national program called Operation Wetback. In that sweep, my father was taken. And Operation Wetback was a effort by the United States government to stop the so-called flow of undocumented persons coming in from south of the border. And under the Hoover administration, the FBI, they teamed up with the National Guard and went sweeping, where hundreds of thousands of people were swept up. And probably 30-40% of those were U.S.-born citizens, children. Well, my mother had papers. She had been brought by a rich family to be their nanny and maid. And they got her papers in order. She had her passport. She had her residency. And eventually she went to night school, received her diploma, and went on to citizenship classes, and she passed and she became a citizen. So they didn't, in that raid, they didn't take her or us because we were citizens. I'm saying us, my mother, myself, and one of my brothers. And after that, I didn't see my father for years. And that's where I think for me, as a kid, as a child, it was like something surreal, a nightmare. I didn't know what was going on. I remember that night, I closed my eyes and I'm back there where they came and took my father. And my father wasn't a big man. He was a kind of small structure. He was, you know, I believe 5'8", 5'7". He was as tall as my mother. My mother was 5'7". But he was a stocky man. He was a big, thick man. When they came, he wouldn't go because he had his underwear on. He had his boxers and his T-shirt, and he wanted his pants and wanted his shoes, and they wouldn't do it. The house we lived in wasn't a house. It was like a weigh station for trucks to be weighed, and my father connected it, hooked it up to the chicken coop so we could have more room. So we lived in a chicken coop, basically, and the door had a little hook. It had no locks, you know, had nothing except this little hook. And when they came in, they just kicked the door in, and my father woke up, and the next thing I know, they're taking him, and he wouldn't go because he wanted to get his pants. And that's when I saw them beating my father because he wouldn't get on his knees. But eventually, you know, the soldiers grabbed him, and they started using their rifle butts, and that brought him down to his knees.
What was your mom?
My mother came out with a big spoon, and somebody hit her, and she fell down, and I thought she was asleep, but they knocked her out. At that point, the lights were blaring. There was floodlights on the little house, coop, and I could hear in the dark, and I could hear there was trucks. It was like big Mack trucks, like cattle trucks with people in them. And I could hear people crying and people screaming, women telling, déjalo, déjalo, which means leave him alone. In Spanish, and I could hear people screaming. Eventually my father just was dragged away. Like I said, that was my first experience, and I didn't see him for years after that.
And essentially they left you there with your mom unconscious on the floor, and they took your father right out from under you.
Yeah. And it wasn't until the next morning, and I grabbed that spoon. It was a big wooden spoon that my mother used for the beans, for making soup, for making whatever. It was a big wooden spoon. I screamed till I couldn't scream no more. And I was in shock, but I kept screaming until I just didn't have a voice anymore. Eventually the sun came up, and my mother was still laying on the ground. And my baby brother, my second brother, Daniel, I don't know how, I don't even remember, but he came out of the house, don't ask me how, and he's like laying on top of her. Somebody that knew my mother and father drove by, because we were right off the old Redwood Highway, 101, and stopped. I don't know why he stopped. I guess maybe he saw something and he stopped. And next thing I know, there's people there, and my mother revived. She had a big welt on her face and on her head. It took me days to get my voice back. Part of it was I was in shock. But I remember that I swore to myself that when I grew up, I was going to make sure this would never happen again. That, you know, kids' mother and father wouldn't be taken away. And here I am, Dennis, you know, 50 years, 60 years in the future, and it's still happening.
And we are talking with our own Miguel Gavilán Molina, senior producer for Flashpoints. And we're talking to Miguel about his life as he gets more and more involved with the battle to get justice for a young man Andy Lopez, who was gunned down by sheriffs on October 22nd. And we wanted to talk with Miguel about his own life. Well, after they beat your parents unconscious and took your father, you ended up having to, essentially, you became, if you will, the man of the house. You worked with your mom to take care of your brothers. You had several brothers, and you worked in the fields, right? Well, what happened then?
Well, in those days, you know, my mother had learned English. She could speak English and Spanish. And, you know, we went into the fields. Because she could speak English, she ended up being a forewoman, like a foreman. In those days, the crops out there were prunes. I think Healdsburg was a prune capital of California. Sun-dried prunes and grapes, apples, pears, strawberries, cucumber, beans. You know, we picked all those crops. And my mother would get paid a little extra because she was a foreman, a forewoman. That always interested me because I, you know, in the Mexican culture, it's very much male-dominated. And yet, my mother's a woman, could deal with men. And somehow she managed to get the respect of men who didn't resent her because she was a woman. And, you know, we'd be out there. You know, I would get up in the mornings at about 4 o'clock by the smell of my mother making tortillas. And that would awaken me, and my job was to get the equipment ready, the jugs of water, that which were covered in can.
How old were you?
7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, as early, it was my task to get all the equipment, to get the gloves, and to prepare the water jugs. And the water jugs were 1 gallon glass bottles, and they were, my mother would wrap them and sew them in gunny sack. And then the gunny sacks would be wetted down. And I'd put them in the, you know, whatever truck, whoever came to pick us up to take us to work. And we'd be out in the fields by 6 o'clock in the morning and work from 6 to 6. With maybe about a half-hour lunch and no breaks. My job was, like I said, to get all the equipment loaded and then make sure the gunny sacks were wet. And once we got to the fields, wherever that was, I would look for a dead tree that had, you know, a hole in it, or I would find somewhere where there was a, you know, like a hole underneath the base of the tree by an animal, a raccoon or a fox. And I would put it there because I knew that under the ground or in a dead tree, it would keep cool and it would keep the water cool all day. And the gunny sack, being that it was wet, it would preserve the coolness of the water. Because by 1 or 2 o'clock, you're out in their fields, you know, it could be 90, 100 degrees. And if you don't keep the water cold, drinking hot tea water is not a good thing. And, you know, when you're burning up and you need to be cooled down. So that was one of my tasks, you know, early, just getting everything prepared. And once I got everything done, I had to go back and help my mother get my brothers and, you know, my sister ready and clothed and onto the trucks.
Everybody worked.
And except the baby who, you know, and he would be in a fruit box. And we would drag the fruit box as we're moving along. And that would be like the crib. Yeah, everybody had to work. Even the, you know, my brothers that could barely walk, you know, a little toy, like those little, you see the little buckets for like going to the beach and, you know, little buckets for kids to play with sand. Well, those little buckets were actually buckets where the little ones could pick the fruit and it was a game for them. Fill up the bucket and then drop it in the box. Yeah, everybody worked because everybody knew that if you wanted to eat, you had to work. Otherwise, there was no food. And our reward was if we worked during the week and didn't complain, because we worked from Mondays through Saturdays, that if everybody worked and nobody complained, didn't give my mother a hard time, then we would get meat come the weekend. So that was the motivating kind of force for us. Oh, God, getting meat? You know, people take that for granted, like, you know, like it's no big deal. But if you don't have the luxury to eat meat when you feel like it or when you want to, it becomes a special treat. And sure enough, you know, if we worked hard and didn't complain and we made our quotas, my mother on Saturday night would go to the store and find the biggest steak and buy it for us. And that was a treat by itself, you know, God, getting the meat. Sometimes if we worked really hard and even surpassed our quotas, she would send somebody out to get a steak or meat for that Saturday afternoon after we finished. And that brings back an image that when we knew that, because she would tell us Fridays, well, you all made your quotas, I would ask. She goes, yeah, everybody's worked good, nobody's complained. You know, you guys are going to get a treat. That meant that we got to have meat on Saturday and not have to wait till Sunday. And when that happened, I mean, there was a whole story I've always shared with my children, my kids, and that is a story called Stones for the Fire. On Fridays, when we knew we had surpassed our quota and my mother was happy, she would tell us, well, tomorrow you guys are getting meat. That would be a Saturday. That meant for lunch we would be able to have meat. So on those Saturday mornings, everybody had a task. My job was to collect the stones. My brother that followed me, Daniel, his job was to collect branches, dried branches for the fire. My brother Cheveto, his job was to collect smaller branches. And down the line, so and the next brother, you know, twigs. After that, my sister, her job was to collect dry grass. And my baby brother's job was to collect dry leaves. So the leaves and grass would start to flame.